Okay.
Excuse me. Okay, so are you recording?
Yes, and we caught the full glory of your belch.
I assume you'll put it in some manner embarrassing to me.
Of course. That's my job.
Welcome to Mustard Mayonnaise. I am Matt.
I am Richard.
We discuss things in the entertainment industry that capture our interest. And Richard's already bored as he's grabbing a magazine and flipping through
it. It's not bored. I'm multitasking. You know me.
That's funny. So I'm a little out of it because I'm on Percocet.
Cool.
Due to some excitement with kidney stones. If you have a choice, kids, don't do kidney stones.
No.
I know.
Do you have a choice? Is it like a diet issue or what's going on?
Actually, there's a couple different types of stone, I guess. I don't know. I have yet to talk to the doctor about what I can do to prevent this.
Because anything I could do to avoid them, I want to do.
Well, I know part of it is staying hydrated.
Oh, okay.
I don't know that that's all of it, but that's part of it.
Hmm. I feel for you. If you collapse, I'll vamp.
You'll vamp. That's pretty funny. Okay, so a slightly, not a very topical list of things to discuss today, but Apocalypto opened this weekend.
Yeah, how'd it do?
Between 14 and 14 and a half million.
But, you know, I was looking at the big prognosticators, and they were all over the map on this. Some had said it'd make 8 million, one said it'd make 22 million. I mean, people just didn't know if it was going to fail or not.
You know, and when it first came out, and it was like sort of the one-sheet treatment, and you saw the title and the way it had that eclipse thing going on, you're like, I really have no idea what this is about. And then you hear, well, it's about sort of the Mayan culture, And that's really all you heard, was it was something to do with, you know, the collapse of the Mayan civilization. And you're like, that actually sounds really interesting.
Absolutely.
That's really innovative. I would like to see that. And then time goes by and turns out it's basically, it's not, a lot of it is a chase picture. It's this one, God, is it Incan?
Well, I think they contrast like an Aztec guy and Aztec.
Well,
and
it's like,
Mayan.
It's a smaller village or tribe.
Yep.
That's basically kidnapped or taken, captured by the Mayans, who were into all this sacrifice. And then one guy, Jaguar Paw, sort of the main character, escapes, and the rest of the movie is a big chase scene, which, you know, and that's all fine. But of course, it's Mel Gibson, so it's gory as anything.
I know.
You know, the reviews I've read mention, you know, disembowelings and, you know, there's multiple heads bouncing down the side of the pyramid. And it just sounds absolutely disgusting.
Yeah.
And you know, they're saying that the rest of the movie is actually directed well. You know, considering it's in foreign language and considering it's, you know, where it's filmed and using all these types of non-professional actors, you know, it's probably a really, really well-made film, but because it's got all this disgustingness in it, I have zero desire to see it.
I don't know. I'm ambivalent because when I was down in the Yucatan a couple of years ago, we went to Chichen Itza and we were looking at a lot of stuff, and I was reading a lot of the books, and I was like appalled at the level of what modern life would say is just out and out cruel barbarianism. And it sounds like he was just saying, that's what I need to show to focus on. So I don't know. It's hard to say. For me, it's all about, do I get over the whole, and I've already decided, I just, you know, Mel Gibson, the Jew hater, and Mel Gibson, the director, I'm going to keep separate. So I actually probably will go see this movie if it presented itself. Because I'm really interested in that, in just somebody painting a picture of that incredible time period.
No. And good for you. I would hear
some people, like I was listening on a couple of radio shows, like on Howard Stern, they were getting all upset about this. They couldn't believe that Disney, to them, it was proof that Disney doesn't like Jewish people, because they were saying, and they're putting Mel Gibson out, they're promoting it as his, you know, as his movie, even after all that, it shows how much. And I'm thinking, you know, Disney has no other choice. If you didn't promote it as a Mel Gibson movie, everybody would have said, what are you trying to hide that it's a Mel Gibson movie? And even if you didn't, it's, what does it have going for it? It's a movie filmed in a dead language with no stars. I mean, literally, you couldn't promote this thing other than with this. So they did everything they had to do. And it is a little, the thing that does disturb me is some people are going to say, if it's successful, see, people don't really care about that, you know, all that anti-Semitism. Well, and I would hope people do care about it.
The box office Mojo site is listing the budget as $40 million, and I've heard other people say, no, it's more like 70 or 80 million. So,
and he financed himself, right? They're just distributing.
I assume, but yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested in seeing it, and I don't like the guy as a person.
Yeah.
That's where I come down.
It's one of those things where he's taking a risk as a filmmaker to make, you know, a film that's not, that you're right, it's very hard to market, but it's such a cool idea.
Yeah.
It's just the fact, you know, and if it wasn't gross, I probably would see it. And I would, you know, and I wouldn't let the male is a dick thing get in the way.
Well,
but
maybe he'll do. You remember when The Passion of the Christ came out and that made an enormous amount of money. And then Easter came around the next year or sometime. And he decided, well, there were so many people that couldn't see it because how violent it was. So he released a cleaned up version. You remember that? Into the theaters?
No, I don't remember that.
Yep. Like 5 months after it, he released a cleaned up version. And it made, like, altogether about $800,000. Nobody was interested in not seeing Jesus get the crap beat out of him.
That would have been a better experiment if they released both at the same time.
Yeah.
Honestly, because you release another edit at the end of the run. That's kind of... That would have been a better experiment if you did them both at the same time.
Yep.
Anyway, I think that's it for Apocalypto. I think I'm done talking about it. So I managed to see a couple of the DVDs I borrowed from you months and months ago.
What'd you see?
I finished A History of Violence.
Oh, yeah.
I think I watched the first half a month ago and finally got around to the rest of it yesterday. It was interesting. It was not quite what I was expecting. You know, I know it's a Cronenberg.
Yeah, it's definitely it's Cronenberg, but it's
and
like,
I haven't seen other Cronenberg films. I know he's got a, you know, sort of this indie vibe. And you could detect that. You could detect there was an indie vibe to this film. There was some very deliberate pacing, and which I liked.
As a Cronenberg fanatic who's seen every one of his movies, and he's perhaps one of my top three favorite directors, it definitely is not that much like the other ones. It's sort of like, it's sort of like he went into this other genre, and there's just few elements from what a traditional Cronenberg would be. So you can get a slight feel for it, but it's definitely different. There's an overall tone that feels kind of Cronenbergish, where when there is violence, you're sort of detached from it. Like there's a scene where Ed Harris. Yeah, Ed Harris has like been shot, and he's like, and that felt totally Cronenbergian kind of thing, where he's got this big gaping wound in his chest, and that felt very similar. But other than that, it doesn't feel quite like Cronenberg movie. But I still liked the movie a lot. It was a weird movie, but I liked it.
It was a bit of a weird movie, and I remember it getting pretty good reviews when it came out. But then my wife's cousin and boyfriend are sort of work in the industry in L.A. and they hated it.
Yeah, Holly, our friend Holly and her husband Mark hated it too.
I didn't really at the time ask them why, and it's probably too late now for them to really remember why, but I'm curious why they would have hated it. Because it wasn't just like, they hated it.
Yeah, so did they. They sent me this horrible, Holly and Mark just said it was stupid. I don't get why everybody was talking. I think part of it was because they had heard all this buzz about it and they could not get what the buzz was. And so much of the buzz was honestly based around Cronenberg is doing a more accessible movie. So a lot of critics embraced it honestly just because it was Cronenberg and he was being accessible.
Well, you know, and it's this interesting, you know, not that it's all that terribly original, but you know, it's an interesting look at duality and how you can go from being a really one type of person to another type of person. And
it's interesting, it's a comic book adaptation, but you listen to the commentary track, and Cronenberg had no idea. He literally did not realize, because he just got a screenplay, and it was like he was halfway through the movie, and somebody told him, oh, yeah, it's based on a graphic novel. And he, like, what? He just didn't even know.
That's interesting, just from the perspective of a lot of people, when they do that, will use the graphic novel or comic book as a storyboard reference.
Oh, yeah, not him. Not him whatsoever.
I mean, yeah. Yep. That's more important in a film like Sin City when it's very clearly a comic adaptation.
Yep.
And there was something else. Oh, was it? And it wasn't. Ed Hurt nominated for an Academy Award Best Supporting Actor for that?
Yes. And I think Cronenberg might have even been nominated for Best Director, but yeah, not Ed Hurt, William Hurt.
William Hurt.
He's like the brother at the end. And
yeah, and I knew that going in, and I'm watching it, and I don't know why. It wasn't a bad performance, but to me, it wasn't transcendent.
Because it's the way Hollywood works, especially Best Supporting Actor. William Hurt, don't forget, William Hurt won 2 Best Actor Actors. We forget that he was one in the early 80s. He was as big of a quality actor as there was in the world. He won for Kiss the Spider Woman. He was nominated for like multiple roles, like for Body Heat and all these other ones. I mean, he was the guy, and he's sort of not been anywhere. And then in that last year, he was in 2 big prominent supporting roles in Syriana and in this movie. And the voters often just, they will give somebody for coming out of the wilderness. And I thought he was good, but I think a lot of that had to do with it's William Hurt. We love the guy. He's a nice guy. And that would make sense
because it's, you don't watch that Oscar.
Yeah.
At least I don't, but yep. Of course I rarely do that. So.
Well, George Clooney won it instead. So all was right with the world.
The other one I watched, yesterday was Brothers Grimm.
Oh yeah. What did you think of that?
I was really disappointed.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew, because the only reason I was interested in it at all was that it was a Terry Gilliam film.
Yeah.
But he just directed it. It wasn't one that he also wrote, which is...
Yeah, but somehow it still managed to be have epic stories of failure with Terry Gilliam, supposed name all over it. I mean, every time he gets involved with a movie, you're right, it was his flair, but even then it wasn't quite there.
No, it really wasn't. It wasn't that well written. Yeah. Matt Damon and Heath Ledger were okay, but they really weren't anything special, to be honest. And I like both of those actors.
Yep, I do too.
And there was this really bizarre, they had Peter Stormare as this character, and he's sort of playing it partly for humor and then partly not. And you really didn't know how to approach it.
What was the tone?
Honestly, it was just a mess. And I'm really glad I didn't pay money to see it in the theater, quite honestly.
And you're glad you didn't pay money to buy it. You borrowed it from me.
Yeah. but, you know, knowing that Tideland still really hasn't been released, and all I hear is bad things about Tideland, which everyone is the next Terry Gilliam film.
Yeah, everyone saw, you'll read a review of it, and people are so beyond appalled. They hate this movie to such a degree that I almost want to see it just to see, could it be as bad as they're making it? Because it's gotten limited little releases here and there, and then somebody will review it, and they're just uniformly depressingly bad. This is the one that has like Jeff Bridges and some kid in some cabin or somewhere.
It's like he dies or something, and the kid is, I don't know if it's fantasy world or whatever, but
yeah,
and I have no interest in it because I suspect I won't like it.
Yeah, I hear you.
God, and it's like, I remember Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I didn't like that movie at
all. Oh, my God. That movie, to me, was unwatchable, and it was entirely unwatchable.
I think it took me about three sessions to get through it.
See, I never got through it. I never borrowed anything, and I know there's like a Criterion Collection version, and I respect Gilliam as an artist, but he made a couple decisions. One, he decided to visually represent the drug-filled haze of Hunter Thompson and his buddy. So part of the way he did that was by to use these unbelievably wide-angle lens close-ups, which is so annoying to me.
Well, that didn't bother me. I just, maybe it's just because I've never done drugs. I'm not a stoner at all. So seeing that world represented, I got what it was, but it was just hard to watch anyway.
And also, I know how Johnny Depp loves Hunter S. Thompson and everything else, but he captured Hunter S. Thompson really well, which is a mumbling, incoherent idiot. And that honestly doesn't translate well to me in movies.
Not so much. I also watched Platoon yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
It was on HDNet or something. Yeah. So I set up my box.
Does that hold up at all?
Better than I thought, because I remember I had seen 2 minutes of it on, you know, TNT or something like a month ago, and the dubbing was so bad because, you know, like, you know, come here, you know, and then the way, God, come here, front door, or what was that sketch where they couldn't swear? Yeah. I don't know if it was SNL or Mr. Show, but whatever. The editing was really bad because there's a lot of swearing in the movie. And then I had mentioned it to you, and you said you had seen it, and it hadn't held up that well.
No, not to me. I remember when it came out, it just being, wow, this is the SHIT. This is the thing. You know, that was incredible. And just walking out like, oh, that was the thing. Then watching it again and seeing how overtly obvious the different metaphorical characters are, the Willem Dafoe Jesus character, and then the Tom Berenger, you know, just all of it seemed way too unrepresentative, unrealistic, and I don't know, it smacked of everything I loathe about Oliver Stone. I literally hate every one of his movies, and the ones I think I like, I watch again and decide I hate him. And right now, the only two that I think I watch again and don't have a visceral reaction to are JFK, which I absolutely think is a ludicrous conceit, because it, you know, but the movie was really good. And then I liked Salvador a lot. So, and I watched that again, and I really liked that as well. So other than that, I look at his movies, even ones I liked when they came out, and I'm going, they're so bad. They're just so bad. And
well,
that's my take on them.
You know, I'm watching it yesterday, and I thought it was okay. Yeah. I thought it held up better than I would have thought.
Yep.
I was Tom Berenger and Willem Dafoe.
Tom Berenger's never been better. I mean, he's like a workmanlike actor, but he was great in that movie.
Oh, and honestly, the makeup job they did on him, the scarring on his face was incredible.
Yeah, it's perfect and wicked, and it looks real.
Does look real. It doesn't look, with 15 or 20 years later, it doesn't look dated.
Yep.
It doesn't look like a prosthetic. It looks really, really good.
It's funny. He's been in all these workmanlike little roles and other stuff, and he was so good in that movie that you're just wondering why before and after that he never became more than kind of this C actor, because he was so good in that movie.
He was in Major League.
Yeah, but and even then it was like, yeah.
With Charlie Sheen, interestingly enough.
I know.
But I don't know. It's
it's funny. You're talking about the dubbing. I was watching Ghostbusters today. It was on Comedy Central, and I'd never seen it dubbed. And I forgot that in the mid-80s, I was watching Trading Places last night. I forgot in the mid-80s, they knew a lot of these movies, so they'd have TV versions. So rather than doing dubbing, they would record alternate jokes just so it wouldn't be so overt. So in Trading Places, they're showing a scene, and there's a scene where Jamie Lee Curtis, that I visibly remember, is topless in this, and the whole scene goes on where she's not topless, the same story and everything, and I realized they recorded the scene twice. And you got to think, boy, that must have been painful, her as an actress. So I'm doing this twice. So there's one that you can show here, but the other one you have to show me naked because it's an R movie. People forget Trading Places is an R movie. It feels like a PG movie.
No, I knew it
totally
was
R. So on Ghostbusters, there's the famous scene coming up where they refer to the one EPA official as dickless here. And then they go, yes, it's true. This man has no dick. Well, in here they call him, they call him Peter W. Wickless or something. But they actually say it. It was some weird later. They say, instead of saying, yes, it's true. This man has no dick. They say, it's Bill Murray saying it, some to the effect of, this man reminds me of a rat. I'm not sure what kind of rat, but he's a rat. What? I mean, that was the joke. It was so painful and lame, but the difference was they didn't dub it over. They literally recorded there, and it was on film.
Interesting.
Thought it was interesting.
And it's one of those things where, like, Trading Places, growing up, we had somehow had a copy of it on VHS.
Yep.
I can't remember if we rented it and dubbed it, because my family did a lot of that.
Yep.
Or if we just taped it off TV.
Yeah.
And then watched, it was one of those watched a lot. We watched over and over. And I'm pretty sure it was the taped version, because I think I remember Jamie Lee Curtis's breasts. But I realize having, when I borrowed the Blues Brothers from you last year, I had realized the version I had watched over and over and over was an off the TV Saturday afternoon with commercials version.
Oh, yeah.
Because I remember seeing scenes I'd never seen before. Yeah. And I was like, whoa. And I realized the version I'd memorized and loved was a horrible edited version. Not horrible, but it's so funny because nowadays I'm so anal about, I don't want to see anything with commercials. I don't want to see anything that's edited. If it's not the full, the full deal, I don't care.
When I was, when I was like, I was 12 years old, Animal House came out, and I guess I was too young to see it, or nobody would take me, but I had purchased this book by National Lampoon. It was this kind of book, all, it was the story of Animal House with photos and pictures, and it told the story, and it was written by Doug Kenny and the other writers. So I grew to love the story of Animal House, the segments of it and various things. One, it would be like cartoon panels. One, it would be a photo essay. It was like this really classic National Lampoon thing when they were actively involved. It wasn't just a name. So I got really used to the story of Animal House. And then when I saw the movie, I was stunned at how many things they changed and how much funnier they were in the movie. For example, early on, when the guys were becoming pledges, you know, the big fat guy Flounder and Pinto, and they would come up with the names. How do you get your names or whatever? Well, at one point they grab Flounder aside and they say, listen, you have to tell a deepest, darkest secret of your buddy, or we're not going to let you in the pledge house. And he says, so he goes, okay, but don't tell him I told you this, and don't tell him anything about this. Well, when he was a kid, he fell in a big pool of tar, and he was able to wash it all off, but a bunch of it got stuck to his private parts. And so he's got spots all over his private parts from where the tar had burned him or whatever. And so they let it go. Then later they're giving everybody their names in their initiation ceremony. And they go, your name is Flounder. And he goes, Flounder. And he goes, your name is, and this is deepest, darkest secret, your name is Pinto. And he goes, Pinto, why Pinto? And then everybody in the room pipes up, 'cause you got a spotted dong. And that's in the book. And it's so funny. I remember laughing. And then I'm watching the movie waiting, oh my God, everybody's going to say you got a spotted dong. So here's what goes on in the movie. Pinto, why Pinto? And then Bluto goes, because. And I was like, what? Where'd the cool, funny joke go? And clearly, because they for time, they probably edited out the previous scene, but it was like, I was like, oh man. And that was the movie. So it's, you know, I was hoping when they put out the 20th anniversary of the Animal House, or 25th anniversary, they would put some of those outtakes in. Of course they didn't. Anyway, that's my Animal House story.
Okay.
Hey, I was going to mention, I was watching CSI the other day, and because I'm an idiot and I watch that stupid show, and they had this one montage scene where this idiot lab technician decides to start dancing doing the robot, but they had him doing it to this incredibly cool version of Word Up. You remember Cameo's Word Up?
It wasn't regular CSI. It must have been one of the other two.
No, I thought it was regular. Maybe it was Miami. Might have been Miami, okay. But it's the one where they, I thought that guy was on. Yeah, maybe it's the Miami one.
Because so, I watched CSI this week.
And no, this was like 3 weeks ago.
I'm good.
Okay. So anyway, he dances to this weird version of Cameo's Word Up, but it's not Cameo. It's this other thing. And like anybody else, you like the song, you immediately go and Google this, figure out who did this. Now, CSI always struck me as they would be totally with it. If they're going to have music on their license, they're going to have like the iTunes thing. You go log on, you can do whatever. I couldn't find anywhere, but I found like literally a million other hits, you know, the in Google. What's the name of the song on CSI, or who's the artist who did it? And it's some weird, obscure gal in Britain named Willis, who's had one EP, and it was released on an EP that you can't even download and barely buy. And then it was released on a compilation CD in the US in this weird, obscure thing. Totally unavailable. And I ended up ordering one. And of course I get it. It's one of those things that says not for resale that they distribute to radio stations.
No kidding.
Oh yeah. It's just some guy grabbed it and sold the thing on eBay. So I paid like $10 for it. And it was kind of funny, you know, how they have those things to radio stations and it says the hit picks on this thing are cuts number 1 and 7 or whatever. Well, this one has 14 tracks and the hit picks, the ones that you should focus on are 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 13 and 14. So apparently two and 10 suck.
That's funny.
But anyway, so I found the song. It's a great song. And I couldn't help but thinking, looking at all the people that were searching for it on the internet, that this poor gal named Willis probably made $50,000 or whatever they paid her to use her song in the show. But, would have made a whole bunch more if somebody had bothered just to upload the thing and get it on iTunes.
It's, you know, and having not directly worked like that, I'm not sure what the circumstances are, but you can make a couple of guesses where, yeah. I think a lot of times if it's something like that, it could just be whoever made that decision, like has this pet song they knew about.
Yeah.
And where, as opposed to, you know, there's like a meeting and they're like, hey, we're going to use the Rolling Stones. Yeah. You know,
I think you're totally right in that case. I think it was somebody, it's like T-Bone Burnett going around and grabbing obscure stuff and then going, oh, you need a montage? I've got a great version.
And
he's just,
exactly. And it's not like they're trying to save money by using a cover. Yeah. I know this cool version.
The thing is, my only thinking was clearly the guy who picked it probably clearly has a love of music. They probably have a music supervisor. And you would, my thinking was just, boy, if you have a love of music, go to the trouble. Throw that artist some money their way by at least, you know, putting it on iTunes. Something. But again, it almost certainly that's the last time they're the CD the other day. And it's it holds up. It's like a funky, slow moving acoustic version of Word Up by Cameo.
It's really awesome. Interesting to think about how music in shows has changed over the years, because between just like, I remember West Wing and hearing a song used in a West Wing that we had just started playing at the radio station.
Yep.
Like a week or two, like very recently, maybe 3 weeks before. And then, you know, they had very clearly put it on as sort of background music in a shopping scene at a mall.
Yep. Yep.
CJ was shopping for a dress. And I remember hearing that and going, hey, I know that song because it's brand frigging new.
Yeah.
On the other hand, they didn't, do a little MTV thing in the corner with who it is.
Yep.
You know, when a lot of commercials these days, Volkswagen or whatever, and they use some hip new song, you see the artist and the album and whatever. They've done a deal where the artist knows they can sell more copies.
Yep.
And it's interesting to see that. And even in promos for shows now, you're seeing that as well. Here's a promo for CSI, you know, and they're playing a song, and then they tell you what the song is in the promo.
Yep.
And you're like, what a weird...
I know, what a weird meta.
Deal, and how... you know, they make a big deal how, John Mayer was on the season premiere of CSI.
yeah, that was the weirdest thing, though. He was actually in the show.
He was as John Mayer.
I know, but he was playing
a small show in a club.
Yeah, and they were sort of implying it was an industry show, so that made a little more sense, but it was so small that you couldn't help but go.
Well, artists like to play smaller venues because it's much less drama. Even when they're like, if they're on a big tour, they'll sprinkle a couple of unannounced club dates in just to keep it interesting for them. And as it turns out, I think the way they did that, because there, you know, he was playing a single, but I thought it was really well done. I was actually really into it.
Yeah. Except for, do you want to really be like? Wasn't that the show where what's her name gets slipped the date?
Yeah,
gets a rape.
Marge Helgenberger.
So isn't that? I mean, of all the great. So what's the backstory while I'm singing? Well, one of our lead characters is going to get date raped. Get raped. Okay.
She wasn't raped.
Yeah, but, I know. That ultimately, I know.
And the other thing I was going to say about that was sorry, the Percocet's distracting my concentration. I just saw a promo because the Kansas City Baltimore game is on CBS and they're promoing Cold Case. Yeah. And like this week's episode of Cold Case, it's, you know, Toby Keith guest stars. Not Toby Keith. Oh, it's another
backwards country singer.
No, it's like Tim McGraw.
Oh,
Tim McGraw good, guest stars.
Tim McGraw, a good Democrat country singer, so I therefore like him.
But yeah, it's like all these awkward let's pull in as many viewers as possible I don't really have a point. It's just kind of awkward to see.
So I got I bought a CD this week, first one I bought in a long while, The Beatles Love. I'm sure you've heard about this thing.
Vaguely.
It's a new Cirque du Soleil show in Vegas.
Okay, yeah, I know about the show. I didn't realize
CD George was Martin and his son Gilles.
So who's George Martin?
George Martin is the famous producer of the Beatles, except for one album, Let It Be, but he produced all their other albums, and he sort of keeps the musical legacy going of the Beatles with their permission. He's the one that re-engineered all of those old tapes, So what they did was they took Beatles songs and they made a show out of this, but they also reimagined a bunch of these songs. Essentially, they did mashups of a bunch of these songs.
So he can... So Michael Jackson's rights are just pre-recorded. He doesn't own anything else.
Michael Jackson owns the publishing rights. So Michael Jackson makes money, But
has he sold those yet, or does he still own them? Well, that's like the one asset he owns that produces money, I think.
Yeah. I think he borrowed against all of that. But he only owns the publishing rights. He doesn't own, you know, there's still the musicians' rights, there's still, you know, other stuff.
That's interesting. So,
but publishing is notorious for being the most lucrative. But anyway, so they put this together, and it was, and it honestly is incredible in a lot of levels. That there, first of all, if you're into the Beatles and you know a bunch of stuff, you'll be hearing part of a song, and then you hear another element come in from another song, and you'll see how they mix together, like Helter Skelter and Blackbird and all this weird stuff. And it's honestly incredible. There's a couple versions in there that are. Part of it's just like it's a straight Beatles song, and part of it where they've taken alternate takes of While My Guitar Gently Sleeps, but underdub it with his final version guitar and all this other stuff. It really, it's honestly stunning. And it's kind of like a new Beatles album. Just really, really cool. It makes me like really want to see the Cirque du Soleil show.
I was going to say, are you going to take your mortgage payment down to Vegas?
Because the tickets are probably $100. But honestly, if I go to Vegas, I could not imagine not going to see this show now. Because A, I like Cirque du Soleil, but B, this is like Cirque du Soleil plus music I'd be really into, you know. So
I'm curious.
I know, it's really cool.
I'm curious to know, because I mean I knew this was happening. I'm curious to know what Cirque du Soleil elements, you know, what weirdo.
I've seen like little snippets, and it's just the weird acrobatic stuff with the music in the background.
Yeah,
you know, the one thing about this though is people forget that Beatles, even though they came up with all this incredible stuff, so much of this was recorded on 4-track systems.
Uh-huh.
So much of what they're doing is actually like using audio software to try to systematically remove vocals that are mixed in with other tracks. It's not like they have this 64 isolated tracks of every element. They've got like 4 tracks and they've got to pull stuff out of there. You know, the one other thing you get out of watching this is you realize, you know, people have always said Ringo Starr is not a good drummer, not this and that. And I'll tell you, the driving force, if you're doing a mashup tape, the driving force is always the drums, because it's the thing that sets the beat that allows you to overlook, you know, slight changes in tempo and stuff. And Ringo Starr is the driving force of this quote album they have. And he's, and you realize, and they've brought him right up to the front, and you realize, you know, I mean it's hard to say if he's good or bad, but he's definitely the force behind this album, and he sounds great. You know, it's just really uniquely great album. I don't know how well it's going to hold up over multiple listens, but the first time you listen to it, it's like, wow, you just got a big smile on your face, you know.
That's cool. Yeah. You know, I have to admit, if I went to Vegas, I would want to see one of those Cirque shows, but there's like 10 of them down there.
Yeah,
there's, and a lot of them sound cool. Like the water one sounds cool. The one with the flying stage sounds cool.
Oh yeah, I know. And they charge a fortune for it.
I know,
them too.
And it's just ridiculous.
When we went down there, last time we saw Penn and Teller, which was fun, but actually I've seen them before, and their stage show hasn't changed that much. And it was cool, but it was like $80 or something. And that's in the new Cirque du Soleil Love is in the same casino in the Rio where there's a lot of cool stuff to go, but it's not like the old days. The stuff is expensive.
Did you,
man,
see NBC has this new game show Identity. Yeah. Hosted by Penn.
I've seen the previews and I thought, wow, they picked the right guy, because Penn and Teller knows how to sell this stuff. I love Penn and Teller, but I only can take Penn in small doses. But it seemed like the perfect game show for him, man.
I would consider watching an episode.
Yeah.
And usually I'm not big on primetime game shows.
I've gotten sucked into that stupid Howie Mandel whenever.
Are you serious?
Every once in a while, I'll just sit there, I'll watch it, and next thing you know, it's like the 2-hour special, it's like 2 hours later.
Never seen it. I mean, what I've seen is the bit that my box catches before it records Heroes.
Well, what kills me is that they highly select the people that are involved, so it's all managed. The show is real, but they get somebody here who is clearly very voluble and a dance up and down. Then they bring their friends in from you know, it's all this managed thing, like it's the football coach, and then they've got some of the football players, then live via singular video phone.
Oh, God.
They have, you know, it's really managed. But that said, it's still kind of fun to watch.
Live via singular video phone.
Oh, it's painful.
That sounds horrible.
Yeah.
So I got the Superman Returns DVD
this
week. And I have to say,
is it a bells and whistles, or is it a?
It's a double disc because okay. I mean, there's a bunch to choose from. Honestly, cool. They put out a bunch of different ones.
And Singer has a commentary track, right?
I'm pretty sure.
I'd hope so, because I've always enjoyed his commentary tracks.
I remember when they filmed it, they made a big deal about they shot the scene when Superman actually gets to Krypton.
Yeah, and they talked about they were cutting it out, and they weren't sure if they were going to put it on the DVD.
No, they weren't. They said it'll end up on a DVD at some point. It's not on this one.
Wow.
Which, A, if it's the case that it's because they're holding out for another DVD release.
For the DVD they'll release in anticipation of the second one.
That pisses me off.
Yeah, I will. Agree.
I mean, as much as I want to see that scene, I'm not going to reward that behavior. That is absolutely ridiculous. And but I really want to see that scene because it sounds really interesting to me. But damn it.
Yeah. I saw that movie twice in the theater because I got sucked into seeing it IMAX.
That's right.
And they had it in 3D, the elements. And I don't know, IMAX 3D just, it basically gives me a headache. I've decided I don't care what the movie is. I'm never going to see IMAX 3D. It just gives me headaches. So, but I love that movie the first time I saw it, and I didn't like it as much the second time. So I think it was one of those doesn't grow on you, but I don't know. I can't wait to see it on the DVD just to hear the commentary track. I just think Singer is a genius. Yeah,
I watched the documentaries, but I haven't listened to the commentary track yet.
On the new King Kong DVD, there's the documentaries they're filming, and one day apparently Singer he was filming Superman in Australia, and he flew over to New Zealand because they show him directing some of King Kong and like pushing Peter Jackson out of the way. It's like kind of a goofy little thing, but clearly he showed up just to visit Peter Jackson and help out. I mean, he clearly directed a second unit scene of King Kong, which was kind of cool. So anyway, yeah, it's kind of cool.
Let's see what else. And I mean, as I surf around the web, mainly in terms of movie sites, and I go to Hollywood Elsewhere a lot, there's all these For Your Consideration banner ads.
Oh, I know.
Which I haven't noticed before. I haven't noticed it prior to this year that they've really, those type of ads I thought were always, restricted to like Variety or Hollywood Reporter or LA area newspapers. But suddenly it's like I'm seeing banner ads, and I saw Superman Returns, For Your Consideration, Best Picture.
For Your Consideration, Best Director. And you're Adam Sandler, Best Actor, click.
Are you serious?
I'm joking. But no, they did have those in those sites last couple of years, because I did see them, and I remember the first time I saw them, hey, I'm reading sites that they think insiders read. I thought it was cool, and now I'm just annoyed by them. Well, but like at the time, I thought it was kind of cool.
There's World Trade Center, there's Little Miss Sunshine, Superman Returns, which I enjoyed as a film, but Best Picture, are you high?
Part of them, they're contractually obligated to do that. They're saying,
really?
Yep, I've seen it where they've had contracts where they say, in terms of the marketing, you must put something like $50,000 or $100,000 aside to specifically market the director and or the pitcher, unless there's some mutual agreement. They might do it if it so clearly would be a joke.
I can see that.
And often it's done to make the director feel better, even though they know there's no chance.
I can totally see that. And yet I look at Superman Returns and I think, how do you do that with a straight face?
Well, they have to do it because they know if they're doing
Brian
Best
Picture. Singer's not an idiot. He knows he's not going to, he's not doing a Best Director caliber job.
But when they do all the, it'll get a slew, hopefully a slew of technical nominations. But you don't really do For Your Consideration for technical nominations. You remind people of the movie, and then they'll put it down. I think that may be where they're going from.
Anyway,
maybe
I'll tell you one thing. Back to Superman, watching these, watching the making of documentaries, and the months and months of wire work that they had Brandon Routh do, so that he could look comfortable in this wire work, and then concentrate on acting. And it's got to be really interesting. It's two years of this guy's life focused around one movie. And you're just trying to compare that to your work day or my work day. We go in, work 8 or 10 hours a day, get paid every, 2 weeks. I get paid every month. Compared that to, being an actor in this case, where you get one paycheck. And then it's like your job is to train, and your job is to practice being in wires and practice the same thing over and over again. And it's got to be really interesting from that perspective of how you do your job and how you relate, how your sense of being relates to what you do.
I know.
Because, you know, it's for so many people, it's, you have this 40-hour a week job, and it's got, anyway, I don't really have a point. I just find it fascinating to contrast and compare, you know, when your job is to practice flying around in a rig.
Well, it's funny to think it wasn't at a desk until basically the early 80s, no actor ever did that. An actor signed up for a role, and if you had anything like that, you'd have a stuntman do it for you. Any action. There wouldn't be much action, but if you did, and in the mid-70s, you might have actors do some kind of scenes, but basically before that, if there was any action, you'd cut to a long shot, and who's that tall, thin, muscular guy where did Cary Grant go? Because this guy is not Cary Grant running. And then they cut back to a close-up of Cary Grant with sweat on his face. Usually it's
very obvious.
Yeah, and nowadays you rarely see that. And there's a scene where they start on Tom Cruise's face. He runs across some rooftops off this other rooftop where there's like a camera swooping over his head, and then onto some steps. And it's not hugely dangerous, but it's enough to go, my God, I'd be terrified as a director. And I was assuming they had a stuntman, they morphed his face on there. And as they point out on the comment, because actors are expected to do everything these days.
Yes and no. Like Tom Cruise famously does his own stunts.
Well, we know he doesn't do, you know, a lot of them, but in this one here, you're watching that going, wow, I wouldn't have had him do that one. And it wasn't huge. It just seemed enough that if he had jumped wrong and twisted his ankle, it would have been out for months.
I would say that harder to tell who's a stunt person and who isn't in recent years, because you're exactly right. And in looking at, you know, the Superman documentary, they had some stunt people.
Yeah.
You know, a guy in a super suit falling down some stairs. I had no idea. And it's, you know, you're right with face, you know, with face mapping and the ability to replace faces, it's getting a lot better.
Speaking of Mission Impossible 3, I listened to the commentary, which was Tom Cruise and, J.J. Abrams.
Really?
And you know what though? You know, first of all, I like Tom Cruise. I know he's weird and I know he's nuts, and I just feel people should just, you know, if you like the movie, see him. If not, just don't factor in all that stuff. But I'll tell you, I've seen a couple commentary tracks where he's been on them, specifically I remember the Jerry Maguire one, and Tom Cruise, boy, he loves to kiss up to these directors saying, oh, you're great, and I don't know how you do this. He is so clearly the big dog in the room. Uh-huh. And to some extent, you can see he picks directors where he's given them a chance, but where he can control and dictate an incredible amount, but make the directors feel like they're doing a lot. Because it was kind of painful in that you listening to this. First of all, they are so obsequious to each other, how great they are, how incredible these actors are and actresses are. And you just want to cringe after a while. But it was, I remember listening to the Jerry Maguire commentary track, and they had Renee Zellweger in the room. They had him, they had Cuba Gooding Jr., and I can't remember who else. And you,
well, that was it.
And okay, and then you could just hear the pecking order in the room. How you know, he was really cool to Cuba Gooding Jr., but Cuba Gooding Jr. was not quite on the same level as he was. And it was a totally weird commentary. You know, Tom Cruise definitely has a monstrous ego. So it was one of those commentary tracks that after a while you're going, God, who else is going to come up on screen where they're just going to tell you how wonderful and great they were?
Interesting. And just to digress for a moment, it's confirmed now that J.J. Abrams will direct the next Star Trek film.
Sweet. So it's confirmed because they've been bouncing in and around. Yeah, because
he was like, no, I'm just producing and nothing else is decided. Yeah. Well, now he's apparently said, yes, he is directing. And I think they pushed the date back, too.
You know, haven't finally seen MI3. I liked it. I thought it was great. And what was interesting was they were showing Mission Impossible 1 on TV the other day. And first of all, I didn't realize that movie was like 10 years ago. I had no idea it was a 1996 movie. For some reason, in my head, it was fairly recent. Uh-huh. And I should have known when they were like commenting going, you need to get on the internet to find this thing out. And then he goes to a page and it says accessing the internet. And then he goes to a email, and the email is job@316. no.com, no nothing. It just makes no sense. But anyway, watching that, I realized what I really liked about the first one, it was big and goofy, and it had these big wide angle lens shots up, you know, typical Brian De Palma things. And this new one clearly was heavily influenced by Bourne Identity and that kind of more modern thing. And I realized, well, yeah, this whole arc of movies has taken place from the mid 90s when big and goofy was more into, now they have to be more realistic. And I thought they did a pretty good job of doing that.
I thought about getting the Mission Impossible triple pack DVD set. I just put that.
Is
on
there
my,
anything extra on them, or
I don't know. I'll have to check. I'll put that on my Christmas list.
Because I now have all three of them, but I didn't even bother. I know there was like a 2-disc version of this third one, and I looked at that going, you know, thankfully they put the commentary on the single disc version, and I can't imagine me being interested in anything beyond the commentary. So I gladly bought just that one. But the second movie was so bad, I thought, and in retrospect, I just hated even more, that I could not imagine, unless there's something unbelievable.
Well, just to get the first and the third, which I enjoyed, I would take the second.
Yep.
What else do I have on my list here? Oh, did you see this study? Because it was reported on a bunch of websites by, was it Sinfonium? I don't know. Someone did a study comparing favorable impressions of HD DVD versus Blu-ray, just sort of as a whole branding thing.
Yep.
And HD DVD is like 40% more favorable impression than Blu-ray.
Really? These are of people that have them, people that don't have them, general consumers?
I don't know any more than that.
I have a favorable impression. Well, because it's the one, the Microsoft version.
And a lot of people are saying, well, and
from
what I remember of the articles, God, nobody's staying to watch this game. Those stands emptied out.
Do you blame them?
No, when your team is down 20-3 with 3 minutes left in the fourth quarter, it's time to go home and do something else, I guess. But I guess a lot of it has to do with people feel, or one of the things that was brought up, I want to parse this correctly, was people were negatively inclined to being forced to accept the Blu-ray player as part of a PS3,
yep.
Which is interesting, because I thought from Sony's perspective, it wasn't a bad idea,
yeah.
Because you increase your adoption. I mean, obviously if you do it by jacking up the price, that's the trade-off and that's the negative aspect. But if price wasn't a factor, I thought that was a really good idea.
Yeah, I did too. And plus, ultimately, you're kind of telling people, you know, we may not have games that fill this now, but we've got 40 or 30 gigs that we can fill these versus this, the Xbox, they're limited. They're, you know, it tells people we're using the Blu-ray for the games, and that's going to be an option.
Well, it gives that impression.
I know, and it's not true. You heard what happened with that one game where they took it and parsed it and broke it down, and they said we filled the disc, and it turns out it was 17 gigabytes of garbage that they just filled the disc with, just lead out basically. So they were basically lying, which I thought was funny.
You know, and there's a couple different things going on here. One, obviously, you can't look at that decision without taking price into consideration, because that's what makes the PS3 ridiculously expensive. That's what made it difficult for them to manufacture, because the Blu-ray diodes were in short supply. So they're, you know, the U.S. only gets 200,000 units, which is ridiculous. But then a lot of people compare that to the Microsoft solution of, if you want this drive, you're not forced to take it. You have the option of just getting the drive, which, aside from the fact that I would prefer it to be integrated into one unit, it's a brilliant take it or leave it decision.
Yep.
They're not forcing me to spend money I don't want to spend on something I don't want. Whereas,
that's what I was thinking.
Whereas Sony is, and I think that is playing a much larger role, at least in this particular survey. And so it's really interesting that, and I, you know, that wasn't the only factor in the favorable impression, but I'm a little surprised that it would be that significant.
Yeah.
I thought I had one other thing I was going to say that was even so.
I was
original.
Planning on getting the HDDV right away, and then I'm sort of waiting because I know they'll go down, and I just don't have any really hugely compelling reason to get it. I think I might wait till. I don't know. I don't know what I'm waiting for. I don't want to spend too much money. I almost bought myself one of those stupid Tom Toms yesterday, just on a whim. Fortunately, they were out of stock, thus preventing me from spending.
It's the GPS thing, right?
Yeah, I have one for my work van, but it's fun. I love the thing. So, but I almost bought one because they were like on super sale. So
yeah,
but,
you're a bit of an impulse buyer.
Yeah, for expensive purchases. but I decided not to.
Have you any more experience with Xbox Live downloads for movies or TV since last week?
I did download a TV show, some CBS show, I can't remember what it was, and it's quicker, so they've got it a little quicker. Still took the better part of an hour, and so it's still nowhere near as fast as the other, and it just, until they figure that aspect out, it makes these issues, it makes them like a service I just don't want to explore, because the reason I would do this is because I want to watch it now. Go to video on demand, it's now. Go to iTunes, at least when you start downloading, you can start watching while it's downloading. And with Xbox, basically, it might be an hour if it's quick. It might be, if it was like the first time, 5 hours. I don't care what it is. I'm not really making my plans 2 hours in advance. I'm sort of making my plans now. And that's what... So, till they figure it out. The other thing they should do is... To solve a lot of these issues is have a subscription model. Have a if you have all these TV shows on there, have them set up so if your Xbox is on, it will download them for you and manage them. So you're not so worried about as much. You just know, oh, the next time one's available, I get it. But you know,
yeah, we'll see.
It's the one failing I think with Xbox that they're just screwing up to me.
So what my last thing on my list is you know, Apple's iPhone.
Yeah.
Widely, you know, supposed to be announced at Macworld, which is early January. Do you have any interest in an Apple cell phone?
See, I don't care about any of that stuff, personally. I mean, if it's an absolute iPod, I want the all-in-one unit nobody's ever doing, which is a pocket PC, Apple-type media player, and a phone. But there's not really much going on there.
Some early... Last week's Dignation had some early... possible specs where it was like two models, was it a 2 and a 4 gigabyte or a 4 and an 8?
See, I want a hard disk based phone. If it was basically what I want is, I don't want a phone that has some iPod functionalities. I want an iPod that just happens to make calls. My phone isn't the big deal. As long as I can, like, you know, all that other crap they put on phones, I never use. I just want to be able to store people's names and dial out. So, but they keep thinking people want phones and then we'll play some songs. And it's the exact other way around.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and I'm trying to think, you know, what would it take for me to want one? I mean, I was want to the point of actually getting my cell phone's 2 years old now. It's time to upgrade, and I'm waiting to see what happens. You know, but at the same time, is it the video iPod too? Will it have the big widescreen screen? Because if it doesn't do that, I don't necessarily care so much about the iPod functionality. But if it's like just the 2 gigabyte model that I can afford, you know, because I don't know if I want to spend $400 or $500, is that enough? Well, maybe I make that my podcast. But, you know, I don't know. There's so many different factors. But you're right. If it's, you know, I don't want to have to get this thing and have it have limited functionality.
Yeah, that's my concern, exactly.
And you really, especially with iPods, where they rev them so often. Excuse me. And you really have to look at what's coming down the pike.
I know, you're going, whatever they have now, a year from now, they'll have something that will be perfect.
Well, and you have to decide, you know, what's enough? Am I waiting for this one standard feature to be integrated? Do I need wireless? Am I waiting for wireless before I pull the trigger?
Yeah.
You know, did you see that the Zune, I think you forwarded me the article that the Zune dropped from second to the third behind the Samsung?
They lowered everybody's expectation, saying it'll be, you know, it's not an iPod killer, but they were quietly trumpeting, in 1 week, we are number 2 MP3 player in the world. Well,
and then they
dropped to number 5.
Oh, did
in,
they?
In week 3, no, in week 2. They dropped from number 2 in the world to number 5 in the world.
Oh, I hadn't seen that. I thought it was just dropped to 3rd.
Yeah, which is, it's, I don't know. Who knows how it'll ultimately play out, but to me, it's just an epic flop. on a lot of levels. Maybe it won't ultimately be that way. And part of the sales thing is you have to factor in profit margins and everything else, because you could be number five, but if you're not, if your manufacturing costs, I mean, the iPods make an enormous amount of money, and some of these really cheap players that do well, they are built on a really tight margin. It must kill them to see the iPods, because they know iPods literally like are at a 40-50% markup, and some of those other things are like have a 1% markup, or they're sold at a loss.
Really?
Some of them, a lot of times they're loss leaders, they're tied to something else, so they're these cheap little players that you get with this or that or whatever. And yeah,
all right, so before we wrap up here, just kind of looking at what's let's see, today is December
the 9th.
Okay, so next week, The Pursuit of Happiness.
Honestly, it looked horrible, but then I've read some really good reviews, and Will Smith looks great in this movie.
To me, it looks like a good movie. I'm just sick of the commercials and the trailers.
And this is his son in the movie playing his son? Is that
was it?
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that.
I hadn't heard that either, and then all of a sudden, somebody's talking about, no, I think it's his son, and his son wants to be an actor, so I think it might actually be his actual son.
All I can think of is the South Park with the... when the one black kid token tried to get all the other black people to rich black people to move to South Park so we could have more rich people to relate to.
Yep.
And Will Smith moves in, and Will Smith kids are, we're out of money. Do a movie, daddy, please, please, daddy, please, please, daddy, please. And it's so over the top and hysterical. Aragon opens next week.
No interest.
I'll be so happy to not have to see another commercial for that. Not that it's bad, but it just feels like I've seen it before.
Yep. Yep.
Nothing original.
Yep.
And then you got Rocky Balboa, which I'm rooting for, but really don't have any interest in.
Yeah, same here.
Night at the Museum. We Are Marshall. Did you know McGee directed that?
We Are Marshall? McGee?
Which is
Isn't that ironic that he directs a movie that involves a plane crash? Because he's so famously, to use my term, scared of flying, and he would do a movie
To me, it's like, this is the first thing that he directed that I would take seriously.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to know if the movie's good, but I liked the preview. It kind of seemed to capture the flavor. You know exactly where the movie's going, but who cares? I like some of those movies. I like Remember the Titans. I like some of these movies. So an inspirational sports movie, which is, you know, a genre of the past couple of decades.
I would honestly say good for McGee for doing something like that instead of yet another ridiculous.
Hopefully he... Honestly, there's nothing about that preview that says McGee. And if it's true, maybe, you know, you remember how in the last movie when he was doing the second Charlie's Angels movie and he was all upset that people weren't comparing him to, was it Francis Ford Coppola or Martin Scorsese or something?
He said he was going to, well, I remember one quote where he said he was making Godfather Part 2.
Yeah, he's making his Godfather 2, and he was so clearly not joking.
And that's just
because he was basically saying, you know, for the kind of movie I do, I am a genius. I'm doing the great thing. And this here. And it was like, oh, my God, dude, can you, you know, when you're a reporter and somebody's saying that stuff, you're just saying, don't say a word. Let him keep talking. Let him keep talking. But this movie here, I mean, just the preview, it might be a terrible movie, but the preview looked kind of good.
I'm trying
to get Arrested Development on.
No, I'm actually trying to get to the Seahawks game. There we go. And then The Good Shepherd and The Good German.
Cool.
Should be also imminent.
Yeah, it's hard to know. The Good German has been getting such terrible reviews.
Really? I haven't seen terrible reviews.
I've seen like three or four. And basically he decided to do a pure 1940s, you know, kind of movie. Filmed it with 1940s cameras, film stock, lighting, setups, everything else, acting, stories. It's purely that way, and people are just upset by it.
I'm gonna see that one. I want to see The Good German. I may see The Good Shepherd, and the only thing that would keep me from seeing The Good Shepherd is that tired, oh, he works too much aspect of it. I am so sick.
And but I like Matt Damon, and I really like that. What was that other Robert De Niro movie directed? The one about the kid who joins the mob or whatever. The kid who's in jail right now for murder.
I don't remember.
It was like this movie he did with Chaz Palminteri playing a like kind of a local mafia guy and this kid who he befriends. What is it? It was Robert De Niro's first movie directed. I don't know if he's directed any since, but it's really good.
I can look it up on IMDb if you want.
Well, sure, go ahead. But it was around 1993. Robert De Niro, Chaz Malmontari directed. De Niro played the dad in the movie. And I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on the thing. But anyway, it was pretty good. And Chaz Malmontari was great. Sometimes I wonder why he hasn't made more movies, because he was fantastic in this movie.
Yeah, what has Chaz been up to lately?
The kid who was in this movie was hanging out with his buddy, and his buddy went and robbed some store or something.
A Bronx Tale.
A Bronx Tale, that's it. So the kid who was in that movie was with another guy who shot and killed somebody.
Oh, man.
So this kid is now going to prison probably for life, because even if you didn't shoot the guy, it was part of your combined. Yeah, so this poor kid who was in this movie is now going to be in prison for the rest of his life.
Maybe just, what time are we at?
We're an hour.
Okay, well, let's... You want to go over the box office weekend just briefly, then we'll end.
Yep.
So Apocalypto was number one. We discussed that at the beginning of our show.
$14 million, but that's not much during the holiday season, though, for a number one movie.
The Holiday was number two.
What is The Holiday?
That's the Jack Black.
Oh, the romantic comedy. Have you heard anything about that?
Kate Winslet. I heard it's okay.
Really?
I mean, that's the general impression. I can't point to a specific review and say that's what I'm basing it off of. But
I didn't see a single ad for it.
I have seen ads for it.
I saw one poster for it at the theater, and that's it.
Happy Feet, number three.
Still making a mint of money.
12.7 this weekend, total of 137. It says here the budget was $100 million.
Yeah, I saw that. And I saw that it was funny, Flushed Away at a budget of $150 million, and that didn't make anything. Which you feel bad, because it was
I wanted production. That one to succeed.
But yeah, Happy Feet apparently is doing really well.
Casino Royale in fourth with 8.8.
It's amazing how that and Happy Feet have consistently made almost the same amount of money. It was like the perfect release of two movies that completely do not take each other's audience away.
Casino Royale is just under 130 million. It says the budget was 150.
Internationally, Casino Royale is making a... What's interesting... Yeah.
I mean, this is going to make a ton of money. I'm just... 150 million for Casino Royale. I don't see it. It was a well-made movie in some exotic locales.
Yeah.
But to me, that's...
How Flushed Away would be 150 million.
Well, I can remember in... what was that? Final Fantasy, the movie.
Yeah, I remember that.
The cost of the animation studio was built into the budget, and it would have been amortized if they had done more than once.
With Aardman, they did that. They decided we're going to make basically a Wallace and Gromit kind of movie.
Well, it was
with that features,
but
they had to build up
a
studio.
They didn't do it claymation because of the water.
Yeah.
But
they had to build up a studio, basically, to be able to do it.
Except I thought if DreamWorks Animation has a studio.
You know what's so sad about Final Fantasy is that effectively today, to some extent, you could make a movie that looks almost as good as that just using machinima, because your computer cards are so good that what they did there is you could do today, a person could do for probably $5,000.
It was a good looking film. And I think it would still look pretty good today.
You'd be surprised because there's no facial features, and the acting, it's basically dead eyes and mouths that barely move like this. And you look at a lot of stuff today, even in compute, using stuff today that a person on their own could do, you could probably do a better job today than they did for nothing.
Well, I couldn't, but
okay. People could.
So good for Casino Royale.
Yep.
I just think that's fantastic.
But it's funny is looking at its tracking, it's actually not doing as well now as the last two James Bond movies did.
Oh, really?
Ultimately, but internationally, it's doing way better. So ultimately, it's going to make more. But what I think is funny is, as much as we bemoan the James Bond franchise, and much as everybody was going, oh, this is perfect, this is what we want in James Bond or whatever, well, you can understand where Broccoli is coming from. She's going, you know, don't forget, these other movies, they made so much money. And honestly, even though we've reinvented things, it's not quite doing as well in the U.S. The last movie made opening weekend, and this was 6 years ago, made like 30% more in the opening weekend than Casino Royale did. But I think Casino Royale has bigger legs, and obviously internationally. But I think the international thing is just more markets are opening internationally than they ever had before. So ultimately, it's going to be the biggest James Bond ever, but it will probably be the third biggest U.S. James Bond.
Well, I was. There was an article in Entertainment Weekly about history of James Bond and Thunderball.
Yeah, if you adjust for inflation, yeah. Thunderball is far and away the biggest James Bond amazing. Ever. When it came out, it was like the number one movie of 1962 or whatever, and it was enormously successful. We don't even remember these things. So,
number five, Blood Diamond, $8.5 million. So Wells is calling this thing just a flop.
Every time I look at an Edward Zwick movie, I go, okay, that might look good. Oh, that's quality. And then I watch it and they grate on me. They're so sanctimonious. There's something that doesn't quite work.
And this one looks more interesting, but I heard it has the same problem towards the end where you've got a gazillion people firing machine guns at the heroes and they don't get hit.
Oh yeah. Oh, great.
So that's just number six, Unaccompanied Minors, which is another kiddie family. And this,
You know the genesis of that? I was listening to This American Life this week, and they were having this story about this gal who's a writer, and in the mid 80s, her and her sister were flying, through Chicago's O'Hare Airport to go somewhere else, and they got snowed in, and she told her story, and it was funny and amusing, and so this was the genesis for this movie, but they turned it into a modern kid, wacky, we're free at O'Hare. And I'm thinking,
looks retarded.
I know. And I'm thinking,
granted, it's a family film and most of them look retarded to me, but
yeah. Well, I was listening to her. I was thinking, why aren't they actually filming her story? Cause her story was funny and cool and moving and creepy. But apparently no, they just turned it into some stupid kids on the loose family movie. But anyway, either way, I wouldn't have seen the movie. So
yeah. Number seven, Deja Vu.
Yeah, that's dying a quick death.
Well, it's, let's see, $53 million so far, budget of $75 million.
Oh, well, if they manage to keep those costs down, and it does well internationally in DVD, Tony Scott will have made a hit. Certainly better than Domino, which made about $1 million. So,
I have to listen to, sometimes my coworkers get into discussions about movies and there's this one person that thinks they know a lot, but they really don't. And I have to just be quiet so as to not look like a sanctimonious jackass. But that person got off talking about Domino the other day, and I really had to be quiet.
Oh, no.
The Nativity Story, number eight. That surprises me that it's that low.
How much does that thing made?
$5.3 million.
How much did it cost?
Oh, wait, no. Total cum was $15.5 million. Says 35.
Oh, Jesus.
I'm surprised. I would have thought there had been a little more legs for that.
Yeah, they come and go. Well, like they say, movies like that will make money 20 years from now. Although there's so many of them now that it's harder to, but those things, man, every holiday, they'll make money long into the future.
And then Deck the Halls at number nine.
I was reading this thing about the worst like holiday movies of all time, and they point out something I didn't even notice about it. Remember Surviving Christmas a couple of years ago with James Gandolfini and Ben Affleck, and they pointed out that they released the movie in October specifically because they knew it would tank and they could immediately release it on DVD in Christmas, but they would benefit from the October promotion so people would know about it. But they knew it was going to tank, so they actually rushed it out even earlier, specifically so they could get it in on DVD by the Christmas holidays. I had no idea that they did that.
I can't imagine enough people would buy it on the DVD that was.
But again, people, you go to like QFC, like our local grocery store, and they have their rack, they have their DVDs they play, and then they have their holiday DVDs, and they've got eight in there, and there's like classics like A Christmas Story, and then there's like random ones, just completely random ones, but they've got their eight slots and they have to fill them. Well, Surviving Christmas, they're going, well, we want to be that one of those eight slots that gets in a QFC store where somebody's going, I don't know what it is. Oh, it's got the guy from Sopranos. Let's buy it.
There's probably a whole different business model for holiday
absolutely
films.
Absolutely.
And then number 10, The Santa Claus 3.
How much did that make?
Total of $77 million.
Because, the first two, believe it or not, made a mint. They were hugely successful. So I think that one, 77 is, that's not that bad, but I'll bet you they spent an enormous amount on that movie.
I don't know.
So.
I don't know.
Yeah, 70 million. It just goes to show that,
And then 11 was Borat, so.
Borat and Tenacious D's probably down to 20 now.
No, I don't want to look.
They're still out promoting it. They're on, what show are they on this coming week? They're on some new show this week. But yeah, it's too bad.
Okay. I think we're probably about tapped out here.
Yeah, I just found it yesterday. My mom goes, so we're going to go over and do the gift exchange tomorrow, Mitch and Vicky's. And I go, what? Gift exchange? Nobody told me that tomorrow, apparently, like Christmas is when the gift exchange. I have purchased no presents whatever. So I'm about to go over there and receive gifts, but not give gifts, which is the most painful thing in the world. So that's where I'm heading off to.
Let's see. I've got some... I'm going to give you your copies of Brothers Grimm and History of Violence back.
Sweet.
You can give those as gifts.
All right. No. I'm not giving gifts.
All right, dude.
Email address.
You guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com is how you get in touch with us. We had no emails this week to discuss, which is why we didn't discuss any. I'm a big fan of cause and effect. Oh, my God. And with the Arizona Cardinals having just scored against the Seahawks, we're going to end.
With 3 minutes in. Anyway.
All right. Thank you for listening. I am Matt.
I'm Richard.
And I should have said thanks for listening here instead of before.
Yes, that's true.